Welcome to the Platform Journey from Tidemark, a growth equity firm purpose-built to help companies win and scale. I'm your host, Avanish Sahai. This series explores what it takes to build a successful software platform company and get the ecosystem flywheel going. We talk with seasoned innovators who have traveled this road before and can help navigate the way and share their lessons. All right. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of The Platform Journey. Absolutely delighted to have Lara Kamey on the podcast today. Lara is the president of field operations at Samsara, had a stellar career, which I'll ask her to talk about. And just some, I think there'll be some amazing insights from someone who's really been in the C-suite and has advised a lot of C-suites on kind of both their platform and their ecosystem journey. Lara, welcome to The Platform Journey.
Hi, Avanish. Thank you so much for having me. It's awesome to see you again and to have this conversation.
Fantastic. So let's just start with that. I mean, again, you've had a pretty spectacular career. So let's talk a bit about your own personal background and some of the things that you've done, and you've done it across a set of companies, both as an executive, as a board member, et cetera. So just talk a bit about your personal journey.
Sure. Well, like you and like many others, I started my career in management consulting at Bain & Company. I think I suffered from what a lot of people did out of undergrad, not really knowing what you wanted to do, but wanting to work on big, important problems probably earlier than you were qualified to do so. And so, you know, I went into Bain and I thought, gosh, I'll be here 2 years. And 2 years turned into, I think, 17 years. And the reason I stayed, like I think so many, is I continued to get opportunities to like get promoted to the next level, to take on something new, like right before I felt like I was ready for it. So it always felt like I was continuing to learn and grow, continuing to be challenged. And so, you know, I had a great career there. And really interestingly, I spent most of my career in tech, but I didn't start out that way. I didn't have a background in it, you know, didn't know much about it. My first project actually at Bain was for Safeway, you know, the grocery store. Yeah. And, you know, with working on the project, and I was like, geez, this is like 2% margin business, like so hard to do anything new or different with that kind of margin structure. And then I got a chance to work in tech, most of which was local in the Bay Area, because I was in San Francisco and like didn't have to be on airplanes, which was a plus. But it was like, these margins are amazing. Like, look at what these companies can do, you know? And so I'm so glad I ended up on that path, because it's been a great journey. But so I'm at Bain. I've been there forever. My husband's there, like my friend's there. We all had kids at the same time. Like, I was never going to leave.
Family business,
you know, it was a good thing. But I got this headhunter call, and, you know, I usually ignored them, but this one was like, oh, wow, it's ServiceNow and it's working directly for John Donahoe. And John had been the CEO of Bain before he was the CEO of PayPal and eBay. And so he was well respected. And I was like, geez, I don't have time for this, but I'm going to do it. And so anyway, you know, I interviewed and it turned into a job offer. And I had just an amazing career at ServiceNow, where I came in as the chief strategy officer, and I quickly kind of became the person that could like build and fix stuff. So I, you know, sort of gathered a handful of functions in addition to strategy over time. And I started in 2017. And at the time, ServiceNow only was $1.5 billion revenue company and had really just pivoted to be, you know, I think you and I started around the same time, actually.
Very close. Yeah.
And it really just pivoted to be a multi-product company. And so my strategy team had to formulate the like path to 10 billion, which we estimated would happen, I think pretty correctly, by 2024. And as part of that, I got to work with the go-to-market teams, got to work with the product teams, and really think about, you know, what are the products we should be in? What are the markets? When do we build out vertical expertise? You know, how does the ecosystem evolve? All of those kind of big questions. It was super, super fun. I had a great time. And then John, my boss, my mentor, was like, actually, I'm headed out of here. I'm going to Nike and you've got this new boss, you know, meet Bill McDermott. So overnight, I went from kind of one super famous CEO to another super famous CEO. And it was such a great learning experience for me, because it's like both of these incredible leaders, totally different and also totally authentic to who they are as humans, leading this company, and got to learn different leadership lessons from them. So that was you know, so great. And, you know, we could probably do a full podcast on just like lessons learned from different leadership styles, because now I work for a founder and that's totally different too. But, you know, at, when Bill was there, he said, you know, Laura, I think you could be a CEO one day, but you're going to have to run a number first, which is a very Bill McDermott thing to say.
Yep.
And he's like, so I don't know what that is, but I'm going to find a way. And Dave Schneider, who I know you know well, who I absolutely love, decided to retire from being an operator and went to Coatue. And so they split his world in half. And Kevin Haverty got, who I also knew you know really well and I love, got kind of all the sales part. And I sort of took everything else. So everything post-sales as well as the partner ecosystem. None of those functions, by the way, had I ever run before or knew anything about. And so I came in and had this amazing job of getting to kind of transform every piece of that. You know, there are a bunch of things. It was like professional services, customer success, ecosystem, training, CX, and all of those things needed kind of different levers. And I was able to build a new product. It was like the first kind of subscription revenue customer success product that ServiceNow had ever had. And at the time, it became the fastest growing product ever. Now the AI product has taken over that that mantle. But it was such a fun run. And so by the time, you know, I left in 2023, the company was $7.5 billion, and I'd watched this kind of incredible change. But I had gotten to the point where I had kind of done all those big, you know, I love growing, learning and growing. I think that's the theme of my career. And I had kind of done all, you know, turned all the big knobs and what I was looking around. It's like, what's next? And, you know, I thought about what Bill said, and you could be a CEO one day. Well, if you're going to be a CEO of a software company, you either need to run revenue or you need to run product, you know?
That's right.
And I wasn't getting to do either one of those things. And I didn't see a way to control my own destiny at ServiceNow to be able to do that short of the company buying something and running a division or something, which ServiceNow has never done, as you know. And so I started to just be open to looking at the next opportunity. And Samsara came along. I had known there's a bunch of ex-ServiceNow people there on board, and a couple conversations turned into, you know, more conversations. And I started as the president now 7 quarters ago. So I've been here, I think, in quarters now. I've been at Samsara for 7 quarters. And I am the president of field operations, which means that kind of over, I think 60% of the company reports up through me, which is everything pre-sales through post-sales, including, you know, revenue operations, partnerships, all that kind of stuff. And I was really brought in to take the lessons from ServiceNow and think about how to scale Samsara past that $1 billion revenue mark and to create the foundations for a multi-billion dollar company. And so in these 7 quarters, the stock price has gone from kind of 19 to, I think it peaked at 50 something. It's around 40, 45, 40. I don't know what it is today, mid to high 40s. And, you know, my goal has been, first of all, building foundations to scale. So the company grew very, very fast. It's only 9 years old and, you know, very fast growing. And so a lot of the core systems and processes were kind of built for like a $10 million company, not like a billion dollar company. And so there's a lot of just foundational work. You know, I had to come in and like build the first pipeline model. It's like, do we have enough pipeline? Hit the number. Do we have enough sales capacity? Hit the number. Like a lot of foundational stuff.
Yeah.
And then thinking about like, how does this business need to evolve in the future? So we need to, you know, be more enterprise ready. So what is that going to take? We need to continue to have more contribution from international markets. We need more products. We have to sell higher up in the organization, et cetera. So that's been kind of the journey of Samsara. And then the last one was Confluent. I joined the board of Confluent before they went public. So I think I've been on the board for 4 years or so now. Mm-hmm. And that's been totally, you know, also a totally different learning opportunity for me because, you know, that pre-IPO to IPO process is fascinating. Like it's just super interesting time for a company. And these days it's rare, you know, to even get to that point. But I learned a ton through that. And then what does it take to start maturing as a public company and needing to report earnings every quarter and have predictability and, you know, have that kind of model? And so that's been really fun, as well as just thinking about like, you know, I've been an operator for so long. being a board member is completely different, as you know, right? You're more of an advisor, stepping back and asking questions. Yep. You don't want to tell them what to do, because I certainly don't love it when board members try to tell me what to do, you know? So it's been great. I've been very privileged to feel like, I've at the end of the day, I feel like I've just learned a lot at every step, you know?
Well, what a fascinating, absolutely delightful journey. And again, your success and kind of your approach to these things begets success, right? So congrats on that. Now, thanks. You've been, as you just described, you've played a substantial role at ServiceNow on the journey from a billion to 10. And again, amazing working with your team there. And the fact that those dates were pretty far in the future, but the company hit those dates is pretty, pretty awesome. But, you know, driving the business, the platform, the ecosystem strategy, and then now you're building some of that at Samsara. How has your thinking evolved about that process? And you talk a bit about the discipline and some of the core building blocks, but talk a bit about how your thinking has evolved as someone who's advised a number of companies as well on that growth journey of all those processes.
I think we can kind of almost like separate out the platform journey and the ecosystem journey and kind of talk a little bit about the platform first. And so, again, being at ServiceNow over that phase from 17 to 23 was just this kind of incredible learning. And the business evolved so much during that. I remember coming in and thinking like, oh my God, like this company feels like a teenager in like a grown-up body. Like how is it? So you probably remember this. How possibly is it so successful when so many things seem so rickety, you know? Now it's, you know, one of the most respected software companies out there. And so, but I think it's worth defining like how I think about platform, and because, please, you know, everyone wants to, I feel like, be a platform, and I think people will use that in their market. Like every company claims to be that, and there aren't, but they aren't, right? And there are actually multiple definitions of what it means. I think it's like, what is the outcome that you want? You know, why do people want a platform? Well, it's because you have the ability to maintain high growth rates over a significant period of time and grow at scale, right? And in order to do that, there's a bunch of stuff that needs to be right. And I think very few companies actually get it right, and not only have the right strategy, but have the right execution to actually make that real. So let me talk about ServiceNow as an example. ServiceNow is a platform because it foundationally, Fred Luddy built it to be such, right? It
was as a technology.
Exactly. Right. It was built to be like a low code, no code platform for people to get work done. Well, at the time, nobody knew how to sell that. It was like before low code, no code was even a term, right? And no one knew how to sell it. And so it was like, well, how are we going to make it easier for people to understand? We're actually going to put an application on this platform, and that's going to be the first thing we sell. And so I think they were super wise to make that first application ITSM, because it was an existing market, existing spend category, right? And the competitors were like on-prem, clunky, BMC, CA, stuff like that. And so ServiceNow came in with a born in the clouds, you know, SaaS base, and customers were delighted, right? But what happened was that customers actually started to understand truly the power of the platform. And ServiceNow at the end of the day is just like a human or a machine can make a request to do something, right? And then there's a series of logic and workflow and data that then automates that work, resolves that request and gets it done.
Yep.
And so it's like, well, that's not different from HR case management or customer service management. You can use it externally. Or even security, which was super interesting because it's actually a machine asking for something. It's like, oh, there's all these risks. Well, ServiceNow, because it started in IT, you had all this data on IT assets. So you knew what these threats were linked to in the CMDB and like which one actually needs to be resolved first, because which one's the riskiest, you know?
Right. What's a consequence of
the biggest impact?
Yeah. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. So anyway, that allowed for many, many different products to be commercialized based on this product platform over time, because there was an ecosystem. The ecosystem could then build and extend their own applications on that platform as well. So I think it's a good example of like, when I think about a platform, like one that really works, because it clearly has, and it's had those financial results that I talked about as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, I think what's interesting is like, it's not enough just to have that though. Like there are so many things that you have to do right, and so much execution that goes into that. You know, you have to figure out how to move from one product to multiple products. How do you sell those effectively? How do you not forget about your core along the way and keep making sure that that's monetized and you don't end up with a leaky bucket in your core, because boy, that makes it harder. How do you sell to different buyers? How do you sell up to start selling to the C-suite? You have to expand geographically. The ecosystem's role definitely evolves over time. You have to mature your systems and processes. So there's like so much stuff that has to go right. And once you get a certain scale, I ran post sales, that renewal number ends up being bigger than the net new number. And so, if you have a leaky bucket of customers, it becomes very hard to maintain growth at scale. So you have to get very good at understanding your customer needs, keeping them happy, and making them renew and expand over time.
Yeah, I think that coordination of growing, retaining, making sure that the retention is with success, not just because someone's re-upped it, right? They're actually using it and so on. I think there's some fascinating elements of the platform journey where that all comes together. And I think you describe it super well. So having said that, what are the signals you look for? You know, if you were to recommend internally or to someone else, when is a company ready? I mean, you talk a bit about Fred Luddy founding the ServiceNow was actually as a platform technology. But like you said, many other companies think about it. I've always said not everybody should be thinking about it, and they should really start with the why, right? Why do you really think this is something that, what are some of the signals you look for when you say, hey, it's the right thing to think about, and then all the steps you described have to kick in after that? What are your experiences around that?
I mean, you could probably go into sort of every single element and have like a thesis level conversation on this kind of stuff. But like the shorthand for me was a lesson that I learned from Frank Slootman, actually, who was still on the board when I joined ServiceNow. And he talked about, and I think, you know, this is out there, so he's talked about this in different places, but the phases of a software company, right?
That's right.
And I like that analogy because I think it actually creates like categories that give you a sense of the rough timing of kind of when things happened at ServiceNow anyway, to kind of frame that. And also, you know, as I think about that analogy to Samsara, there's elements of work, et cetera. So I think it does work a little bit. So like phase one of a software company is kind of zero to 100 million dollars, right? Yeah. That's when you're looking for product market fit. You're looking for your ICP, like who do I selling to? Mm-hmm. And for ServiceNow, like we talked about, it was discovering that, you know, ITSM is actually the app to sell. Yeah. And it's like that's how we sell this platform. For Samsara, it was rethinking traditional telematics, right? It was leveraging all those tailwinds, technological tailwinds from 4G, 5G, Moore's Law with affordable silicon, you know, et cetera, to create like a much better option versus what old clunky competitors were doing, built on a modern tech stack, et cetera, way easier to install, et cetera. So that's like that first phase is like you're kind of in product market fit. You're doing a better mousetrap. The 100 million to a billion, this is where you have to continue to make great products and you want to start to demonstrate that platform vision. And so for ServiceNow, that was moving out of ITSM. And for them, it was kind of throwing spaghetti at the wall, following customers, building out the things that customers had started to do, CSM, HR, security. I think that, you know, ITOM was the first thing that they had built out because it's so adjacent to ITSM. Samsara moved from telematics and then moved into dash cameras, which is now the largest product, and then starting to track other assets outside of vehicles, as well as, you know, creating some software-only elements that automated workflows, automated forms for that kind of frontline worker. And so from a go-to-market perspective, this is where you have to lean in and really scale as much as possible. So you're investing in marketing, you're investing in sales, you're learning to sell these new products, you're maybe starting to plant the seeds for an ecosystem, scaling to new geographies and markets, which, as you know, that takes several years to get those flywheels.
You don't always get those right.
You don't always get those right. And they're costly. They're really costly.
They're very expensive.
You have to be super thoughtful about that.
That's right.
So that's that kind of phase. And then once you kind of get to that, you're kind of at this critical mass. Your phase three is like 1 to 5 billion. And this is where you need to continue to evolve to like maintain growth at scale. That's what separates the good from the great, right? That's why how ServiceNow has gotten to the market cap that they have, which is if you had a $5 million deal last year, you have to figure out how you find several of those for the next year or start landing $10 million deals or $15 million deals. So in order to get those kind of much, much bigger deals, now, of course, you have to have the market there, but you have to keep evolving the product portfolio. You may have to start investing in sales specialists, which, you know, the bag is getting more complex. ServiceNow had to do this. But you also have to continue to monetize and grow the core. And, you know, if the core starts to shrink, like that's a real problem. ServiceNow, I think, did this really beautifully through pricing and packaging strategy, where they would basically continue to innovate in the core. So they continued to invest in those core product teams and they'd fence that innovation in a pro SKU, et cetera. And so a lot of the growth in those days would continue to come from the core products, but just like selling the pro version, selling the plus version, you know, whatever it is, which I think is super important to continue to, you know, have a fair exchange of value for that innovation investment. And then I think in order to, you know, get somebody to sign off on a $10 million deal or $15 million deal, you know, that's in many cases going up to the C-suite. So you have to start being more and more relevant to the C-suite. And in order to do that, you kind of have to speak their language. And so that's when companies start investing. ServiceNow, Salesforce invested in verticalization. Oftentimes, and we'll talk about this probably in a little bit, but that's where the ecosystem can really help you because they have, you know, a lot of those relationships. And so that's that phase. It's like continue maintaining growth at scale. That's a hard thing to do. And very, very few companies get it right. I think there are like less than five companies over $1 million in revenue who are growing north of 30% or even 25%. Like it's just, it's a very small number of companies that can do that. And then of course, you know, then phase four is like your giant 5 to 10 million. You need massive nonlinear deals, creative structuring, different financial models, all that stuff.
Yeah, totally. I mean, again, echoing what you said, I was at that journey in those inflection points at Salesforce, at ServiceNow, and on the board of HubSpot. And I think that framing is really, really important, right? Which is, it also comes with that transition from single product to multi-product to platform. And exactly to your point, you know, getting the specialist organization, getting the mix of people who can really address different set of needs, it's a strong opportunity, but it's also a tough transition. So it's got to be
very thoughtful. Which is why I think not that many companies do it, right? It's like few have the market opportunity and few have the execution ability. Like you really need both. And it's rare.
Exactly. So you alluded to this, but I want to double click on this because I think it's a really important point. Sometimes I say, look, a platform strategy and an ecosystem strategy are two sides of the coin, right? They kind of have to coexist, but there is a sequencing, there's elements of investments, et cetera, that have to be aligned around that. Talk to me a bit, how do you distinguish those? And just give me a little bit of your tone and color on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is true. Like at the highest level, I think that's totally true. But I think the way the ecosystem strategy, like what it is and how it evolves, can be very, very different across different companies, right? Based on a bunch of different factors. So who are the customer, the buyer? What's the infrastructure stack of that company? You know, where do you play in the stack? Where does your product play? What is that win-win-win equation that I know you've talked about before that I always think about? Like, what's the win for the customer, the win for your company, the win for the partner? And, you know, of course, that those phases, right, where you are on that growth and maturity will change. And so I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all strategy, but I do think the general statement is true that, like, as you, you know, progress through those stages, you know, your ecosystem strategy gets, your ecosystem contribution gets bigger and more important over time. So, like, if I just give you the examples of the companies that I know, like how I feel like are different across that, like ServiceNow, I feel like has that classic enterprise SaaS ecosystem. And you know this obviously super well. It includes the GSIs, you've got the Accentures, the Deloittes, et cetera. You've got small regional players, many of whom, by the way, gobbled up along the way by those GSIs.
Which is proof that the system works, right? I mean, that's part of the signals you actually see that, hey, if there's a roll-up happening, it's means that there's an interest in that space. But sorry, keep going.
No, I think that's a really important point. Service providers, there's, you know, emphasis others. And then tech alliances, right? The Adobe's, the Microsoft's, et cetera. Yeah. Samsara is much more of a vertical technology than ServiceNow. It sells to physical operations customers and it sells to line of business buyers, not to IT. And for Samsara, it's not just software. There's hardware as well. Even though it's monetized as software, there is hardware. And so if you think about it, the services work is very, very different. Like at ServiceNow, you'd sell a project and it would take, you could never demo the technology, right? Like it would take 6 months to get it live, and a lot of services work. Like the, you know, the multiplier on services to software is like 3 or 4x, right? Yeah. And so that's just very, very different. Like at Samsara, you can, you know, across, let's say a fleet of 30,000 vehicles, you can kind of get that stuff installed in like 60 days. And the installation and the setup of the software isn't the hard part. It's like getting the vehicles in one place to do it. It's the hard part, you know?
It's actually the physics of it.
It's the physics of it, totally.
Yeah.
And so it's like very, very different. So you don't have services partners that can create massive businesses around this, because it wasn't designed to be complicated like that. Now, maybe over time, as more software products are released, et cetera, there will be a different role. Again, that would evolve, like as the company evolves. But what's super interesting is if you think about the win-win-win equation, insurance companies are actually, at this point in the journey, probably the most important partner for Samsara. Because if you think about it, like the value proposition that we're selling, the ROI, is like, how do you keep these businesses, you know, more efficient, safer, more sustainable? And like safety is obviously a huge part of what all of the companies want. Also, it's what your insurance company wants, you know? So so that's been a really, really interesting partnership. And there's lots of different models around that, et cetera, with Legion, subsidies, et cetera, where insurance is a partner that certainly wasn't a big deal at ServiceNow, as an example. Mm. And then Confluent, which is, you know, the other company I know well, is an infrastructure technology company, right? And it's fundamentally built on public cloud infrastructure, which was super different than where ServiceNow was when we were there. And so there's a natural partnership between the public cloud companies and Confluent. But at ServiceNow, you remember, it was almost like a third rail. It was like, we have built our own tech infrastructure. It's custom made for exactly what we need, et cetera. It's way more efficient.
And we can never run it anywhere else.
Never run it anywhere else. You know, it was religious, I think. And it was probably a 5-year journey to actually get ServiceNow to run in the public clouds. And really, that was, again, based on this kind of win-win-win. There were so many customers that had these big commits on public cloud. And it's like, how do I burn down some of that commit, be able to leverage ServiceNow in that environment? And so they had to, you know, do the engineering work, do the go-to-market work, et cetera. But now I think the biggest deals, you know, that ServiceNow is doing are with these kind of in partnership with these public cloud companies, which is, you know, another, you know, sort of example of how this evolves over time.
Yeah. And how relatively quickly it does, right? Sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And so like, you know, totally different types of partners. But if we go back to the phases that we talked about, like, I think they, you know, they kind of, there's an analogy for the partner ecosystem. And I think ServiceNow, because it's the most mature, has the best example. It was like, I mean, ServiceNow and Samsara, frankly, started as a very direct company, right? Direct sales. And so phase one, when you're in that kind of product market phase, you actually view the ecosystem as your enemy, because your competitors, your legacy competitors, actually have relationships with different ecosystem players and they're selling against you, right?
Yep.
Like,
yep.
And so there's all of this kind of emotional baggage that your sales force has, which is just like, oh, you know, I have to get around these guys. But then
they're going to screw up my deal,
you know? But then phase two, it's like, that's when ServiceNow really started to win partners over. And and many of them started to build small practices around ITSM to begin. And I wouldn't say it was proactive yet on the partner's part. It was very much like ServiceNow was enabling a ton of that. It was helping to build momentum. It was putting a lot of investment in the ecosystem, was doing a lot, you know, all of the work that you need to kind of drive that. But then by the time you get to phase three, that's when you really start to see that flywheel like really moving and partners are truly elevating you. And that's where your like partners are introducing you to additional buyers. They have deeper relationships with HR than, you know, Deloitte knows HR way better than ServiceNow knows HR, right? So they've got this vast scale, these vast relationships, they're expanding deals, they're opening up deals. And I think, you know, that's when you have this like culture shift. And Dave Schneider, I think this is one of the most, he's so brilliant in so many ways. One of the most brilliant things that I think he did was invite partners to the sales kickoff. And I honestly don't know, we don't do that at Samsara. Like, I don't know
most,
other companies.
Most companies
do
don't.
That,
most companies
right?
don't.
Right. And yeah. What's amazing is it's like, we're all in this together, guys. Like, learn yeah. about our latest innovation. Learn about how we're enabling the field. We want you enabled. We want to sell side by side. I mean, it's such an incredible message to kind of really keep that motion spinning. So
yep.
that I think there is a really good analogy of, you know, to your point that these kind of things evolve together.
Yeah. And I love your comment about the insurance category, for example, to Samsara. And I think the implication of that to others is it's not always a linear, hey, here's the four pillars or buckets of tech partners and RSIs, GSIs, and resellers and so on. It's thinking about what matters to your customer, first of all, right? And
yep.
your business. So I think that's a brilliant insight in terms of this exercise has to be strategic and
yeah.
think it through rather than just try to do the same as someone else did. So yeah. we talked a lot about the phasing, the opportunity, the scaling. We all know it's not easy, right? So let's look at a bit of the downside. What are some of the challenges? What are some of the experiences you've had? What are some of the things that like, I wish this were different, but it is how it is, and you just have to overcome those challenges.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of the failures stem from not getting that strategic foundation right. You know, like you said, it's you have to have the win-win-win, right? It has to make sense for the partners because they are just rational businesses allocating their scarce resources like any other rational business on what's going to drive their results, right? And the same for you. Like if you're spending a bunch of money investing in the ecosystem and your sellers aren't seeing results from it, don't see benefit, it's like going to be very hard to maintain that investment over time. And then for the customer, it's like, it's got to make, you know, have that 1+1=3 kind of outcome. Like it has to
yeah.
be better for them as well. And so you need customer intimacy to do that. You need partner intimacy to do that. And you need a bit of strategic framing for your own business. So that to me is the biggest like kind of table stakes thing that you have to get right. I think sometimes what I discovered at Samsara was early days, there would be like kind of money thrown against the wall for different kind of partners. And it's like, I have to totally redo this program because it just doesn't have the win-win-win characteristics, you know, and you're literally throwing money out the door at that point, which is, you know, nobody can afford to do that. But once you find that win-win-win, then it just goes back to the humans. And I feel like every major transformation just goes back to the humans, you know, and you got to figure out how to bring the humans along with the change. And I talked yeah. about the, you know, Dave Schneider inviting the partners to sales kickoff, right? You need the sellers to understand not just the longer term strategic value, because you can ask somebody to be a good soldier and like, you know, this is good for the company. But for a seller, like, what's in it for me, right? How is this going to help me meet my quota? How is my paycheck going to be bigger because of what this partner is bringing to me? And you have to have the data to prove that, you know, and the storytelling. Like, storytelling is an insane superpower. And so, you know, you got to show the data. It's like, okay, here's how many deals that are being sourced by partners for the field. You know, sourced yeah. is such an important metric. This is how, when partners are involved, deal size is actually getting bigger. Close rates are higher. You know, you're selling, you know, higher up. You're mapping to higher parts of the company. Deal cycles are shorter. And then, you know, you got to tell the stories. You got to bring people on stage and let them, you know, tell the stories of their great win and the role a partner played and tell their friends. And you know, it's just all of the kind of change management 101 of getting people to buy in.
So here we're in 2025 doing a podcast. And not only did we not mention AI, you actually mentioned people. Amazing.
Maybe my downfall. I don't know. I still believe humans will be around, you know, we'll play a role.
I'm crossing my fingers. I hope so. So look, in that answer, you also cover some of the key success metrics. So I think those are things that everybody has to be on the lookout for, right? It's the impact, deal cycles, shortening, access, storytelling. Again, Some of it is basic, but what does surprise me is sometimes how often people forget the basics. So it's great, great to reaffirm that. As we get to the end here, any words of guidance? You've been at the forefront of a lot of these transitions. You've seen it in different size of companies. Any words of wisdom for someone like you, maybe embarking on a similar journey elsewhere?
I think there's so many things, but I think there's kind of two ground truths that I think need to be true for some of the success that we've talked about, those outcomes. And the first is that it really all starts with the right products and the right market, right? Like from my path to 10 billion strategy days, it's like you need to have the product market fit and enough differentiation from competitors that you have like a right to win. And then you need the big enough market opportunity, like the size of the prize has to be big enough to make it worthwhile, right? Because it takes a lot of effort to get these things right. So you have to be laser focused on that, not just for those market extensions, but also for your core. You know, what I think happened at ServiceNow, happened at Samsara is imitation is the highest form of flattery, right? And as your company finds success, competition, copycat companies, they will crop up around you. You need to continue to innovate and maintain that advantage in your core products and market.
Yeah.
So that's a super, super important one. And I think one that ServiceNow did really brilliantly over the years. But the second one, and this one I've really reflected on over time, and that's where the phases are interesting as well. Like once you get big enough, that you kind of get this flywheel of success, and that creates momentum for your company that's really hard to stop, right? Because you have the customer relationships. Customers love you. You know, you know folks. You've got a ton of data from the installed base that you can, I'll say the word AI, you should be investing in AI and being able to leverage that data asset, right? You have financial power. You have way more money to invest than any startup, you know, that's coming up. And you have brand recognition. So you have all of these kind of powers that are there. And as I think about at Samsara, when we think about entering a new market, you know, I talk about there's all these kind of startups out there in physical operations land. It's like, you know, we're able to leverage our customer relationships and get in there and stand side by side and understand their business needs so we can build the right product. You know, we can iterate on that with them and get their feedback along the way. You know, compare that to a startup, right? That doesn't have those relationships, doesn't have that benefit of the access, the trust, the financial power, all of that stuff. It's super different. And when you wrap that with a platform vision, an ecosystem, you have this kind of unfair advantage that creates a very, very long runway for these companies to be able to succeed and build really big, enduring companies over time. And I think it's obvious. And then you start to sort of recognize the power of it. And you're like, wow, it's a superpower.
It's happening. All right. I cannot thank you enough. What a great set of insight. And I know we could probably have talked for a lot longer, but I really, really appreciate it. And great to see you again. And keep on trucking.
Well, it's great to see you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Lara Kemi, President of Field Operations at Samsara, for joining another leg of the platform journey.
Thank you for joining us on this leg of the platform journey from Tidemark. For more insights, subscribe to this podcast and visit us at tidemarkcap.com.